When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There was a period in which we had the Pope visit, and that was 12,000 people on the lawn. And then we had the state dinner, my first state dinner of China. China came, the leaders of China came, and that was 2 days later. And then 4 days after that, we had to go to New York and put on the United Nations General Assembly receptions, which is all the world leaders. And usually those things happen span out, but ours all happened in less than a week. And I cannot believe to this day that we survived that.
Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. Beauties, the best part of my Mondays, which I think we can all agree is a day that gets a bad rap, is introducing you to a super cool woman with a story to share. So buckle up, because today we're spending time with a woman with a one-of-a-kind story. Please meet author Disha Dyer, who joins me to crack open her fantastic memoir, Undiplomatic: How My Attitude Created the Best Kind of Trouble, which chronicles her rise from being a 31-year-old community college intern to White House social secretary in the Obama White House. Yes, the book gets into Disha's days throwing buzzy White House events, ranging from the Pope's visit to concerts with Aretha Franklin. But the book's beating heart is Disha's battle with a heavy dose of imposter syndrome and her coming-of-age journey to recognize her talent, value, and belonging, both on the world stage and in her own life. I am excited to explore this all with her. Welcome, Disha.
Thank you so much, Katie, for having me here. I'm so excited to be in conversation with you.
Well, I am super excited for this conversation as well. I've recorded 170 shows.
Oh my gosh.
And I've had so many amazing women on the show, but I have never had a White House social secretary, somebody who worked in the Obama White House. You have a super cool backstory, and I want to dive into what it takes to be the White House social secretary, what you learned about yourself in the process of managing, you know, a super intense and totally unique job. But I would love to have you open by asking you to share the story of how you first arrived at the White House as an intern with what you call a resume full of unexpected detours.
Yes, definitely. And it's interesting because they were good detours, obviously. They led me to to a really great place. But I had dropped out of college when I was 17 and decided to go back to college in my late 20s. And I wanted to be a social worker. And so as I went back to college, which ended up being community college, you know, around age 28, there was this man that was running for president named Barack Hussein Obama. I had not been in politics before. I had not ever met a president. I had no idea who worked in politics, but I was a community activist and had a desire to change things. And so I got caught up in the whole hope and change kind of a vibe of the Obamas. And I applied for a White House internship after getting the application through an a listserv for community leaders in Philadelphia for us to pass on to other students in the area. At first, I thought I was not going to be a good fit for this because I was older. I did not have the pedigree. I made a lot of, you know, different detours, like you said, in my life, but I ended up being the right candidate and they chose me as a White House intern in 2009. And so I started my internship then, which was the fall, and then got hired back a couple months after the internship was over in 2010, and then just elevated from there until my last day in 2017.
It's such a great story. You opened the book with getting the call from the White House. You've almost forgotten that you applied for this internship because you hadn't heard from them in a while and sort of thought it was over. And all of a sudden, you're interviewing on the phone, you're off to the races, you're moving to DC, like you're packing your bag, leaving your day job. What was it like to walk into the White House that first day as an intern?
Oh, Katie, it was scary. I think I was very scared. I was pretty much shaking because I was wearing two different hats. I was wearing this hat of someone who didn't think she was qualified to be there. And I, you know, just thought everyone around me had these four-year degrees or they were in four-year colleges or Ivy Leagues. And here I was at this point, 31, and not sure of, like, you know, why I was here. But at the same time, I was such what I call like a childlike wonder of just, you know, it was almost like a little girl walking into like a Barbie house. You're just like, you know, it's just like, I just kept gasping because it was just like, I can't believe I'm here. And oh my goodness, there's the West Wing. And these are not things I grew up knowing, but I had knew that this was a prestigious place with this big gate. And so it was a mix of like fear and curiosity and wonder and excitement. But it was definitely something that a lot of the interns were feeling, but I thought it was really individual just to me because I was so unlikely, you know, the unlikely candidate to be there.
What made you feel like you were an unlikely candidate? Was it because you were not at like an Ivy League school? What sort of gave you that sense of, huh, do I really belong here?
I think there was a lot of it. I think part of it was my age. I was 31 and, you know, the typical intern age is like, you know, 19 to 24, 25. I think the other thing was that I was going to a community college part-time. And so I wasn't even going to college full-time. I couldn't afford it at the time. And it wasn't a four-year school. And then I think that the other part was I didn't know anything. I was not familiar with how politics worked. I wasn't familiar with the White House and who even worked there or how that even happened. And so I think I felt as if I looked around me and just assume everyone else fit into one of those categories that I didn't fit into at all. And down to my clothes the first day when everybody had like navy and black suits. And I was like, I kind of am wearing like dark khaki pants. You know, I didn't really know what people wore. So I think that that's among the things that made me feel like I stood out in a way that was definitely people could sniff the insecurity on me the first day.
Yeah, that fish out of water feeling, which
is definitely
absolutely zero fun. So, well, you did your internship. It was really fun to learn about your, you know, how that works from your book. You obviously made a good impression because you were invited back for a job interview. You know, what do you think were the qualities that allowed you to succeed and allowed you to be considered for a permanent role, which you quickly moved up the ranks once you got hired by the White House?
Mm-hmm. I will say a lot of this had to do with my age and experience, because a lot of folks that worked in the Obama White House were in their 20s because they had worked on the campaign. They were young enough where they were able to take off time or, like, you know, go right after college or whatever to be on the campaign. And then when President Obama got elected, they became permanent staffers. And so I think part of this is that I was at a mature age and had life experience in a workplace where I didn't have to do a lot of the catch up that a lot of other interns probably had to do simply because they were younger and they had a lack of experience because they had not been in a workplace as long as I had, which had been over a decade at that point. So I think that was part of it. I think that the other part of it is that I just really led with my curiosity. I didn't pretend I didn't know I knew how to do everything. I was very much, this is no, but I know how to do well and I'll learn the other things. And so I never, you know, put on this front like I knew what I was doing all the time. But I really, you know, was able to bring my real world experience and maturity to the role. And that's not saying that the other interns didn't have that. They just had not been alive as long as I had. And they maybe had not been in a secretary for a real estate firm like I had and a social worker. And so, you know, I think that that was really it. And I think I just showed an interest and, you know, again, a curiosity to like what was next and what else is out there. And I worked hard. And I think that's what kind of got me a notice and, you know, got promoted.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had so many guests talk about how curiosity is a superpower and mm-hmm. that it's taken them places that they never could have imagined. So it's so wonderful to hear that, like, your willingness to be curious and vulnerable and to, you know, not pretend that you knew what you were doing and ask for help and learn on the job probably made you a great candidate. I also love the fact that you just identify that some of the things that maybe made you feel like a fish out of water and, you know, at the beginning, you know, the fact that you were older, that you weren't, you know, coming out of a prestige college, mm-hmm. actually worked to your advantage, mm-hmm. right? The fact that you had had all those years of working, you know, in a real estate office, that you had been a, you know, a hip hop journalist, that mm-hmm. you had community activism as part of your background, that you'd done some social work, really allowed you to show up there in a way that made you so effective at your job and put you on a path for being promoted. It's so cool to hear. So
thank you.
A question for you. Was there a specific point in time when you were like, yeah, I've got this. Like, I really do belong in the White House. You know, I no longer feel like a fish out of water. I feel like I've arrived and I belong.
I would love to tell you, yes, there was a time.
No, but maybe it's an evolution. Like, you slowly began to realize.
Exactly what you just said. I feel like I evolved more in the sense that it wasn't that I felt completely comfortable. I belong here. It was more of I'm finding my place here. And so maybe that place is like something that I've carved out for myself here. And that's what's making me feel more comfortable and being used to the environment and being myself and being authentic and being able to bring those things made me more comfortable. So I don't think it was ever a time where I was like, I belong here. It was more of a time like the path that I'm blazing here, the path that I'm on is one that is welcomed here. And so for me, I'm going to stop probably focusing so much on belonging and just focus on what can I carve out the path, you know, that's non-traditional or unconventional, because I want somebody else to then come along behind me and be like, I'm that same person. I feel that same way. And somebody else carved the path for me. Now I feel like I do belong here. And so I think that it was really an evolution, and it was really carving out a space for me in the space where I didn't feel like I belong. I found the sweet spot.
Yeah. I love that. Jisha, we're heading into a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about that road, that path, that evolution, because I know from reading the book that at times it was hard.
I am Patty Callahan Henry.
I am Mary Kay Andrews.
I'm Kristen Harmel.
And I'm Christy Woodson Harvey.
Friends in Fiction is led by four longtime friends, the four of us, with more than 75 published books between us.
Through in-depth conversations and interviews, we discuss the books we've written, the books we're reading, and the art of storytelling.
We're here with endless stories to support indie bookstores, authors, librarians, and readers just like you.
We are always seeking innovative ways to introduce dynamic voices and trends in publishing.
On this channel, you will find hundreds of episodes with some of your favorite authors, including the four of us with our new releases, as we reveal the stories behind the stories, offer writing tips, and talk about the creation of novels, memoirs, and nonfiction titles.
So, if you love books and you're curious about the writing world, you are in the right place.
You can listen to Friends and Fiction on any major streaming platform.
I'm Erica, one third of the podcast Books and Betches, a comedy book podcast where we swear, spoil, and we talk about...
Whoa, 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 whoa. You cannot say that in this.
What do you mean? That's like our slogan. It's our gimmick.
It is, but just say we're a very funny adult book podcast. How about we just give some examples of things we talk about?
Well, there's a lot of chaos.
I'm Kristen, and with me I have...
Wobble!
No.
We talk about books, but we're not your AP Lit class.
I definitely hit on the major points.
You absolutely did not.
She did.
You talked
just
about...
Just not in the order you thought she would.
You talked so slowly about one thing.
A lot of sidebar conversations.
Are you denying the existence of chupacabras?
You know, Erica, yes, I am.
And we don't always get the facts right.
Epilogues don't belong in books.
Call it chapter one.
That's a
the
prologue.
The second I see...
That's a prologue.
Oh,
I'm talking about prologues.
You can listen to new episodes of the Books and Betches podcast every Tuesday morning, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Bye-bye.
Deesha, we're back from the break. When we went into it, we talked about this sort of evolving confidence, this evolving sense that you were carving out a path that you were meant to be on.
but that it wasn't always easy. Because in your book, you explore this struggle with imposter syndrome across multiple chapters. There's a chapter called The Steep Cost of Being Yourself, in which you write that eventually, when you ascended to be White House social secretary in a world that not had not seen a social secretary with your background, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you were getting some pushback even from places like the New York Times. Like, is she up to the challenge of this massive job? You say that you held tight to the pieces of yourself that wouldn't budge, right? Mm. Even if this made people think you were combative and difficult. And I wrote something down that you said, quote, "I had to divest from the need to seek and want approval. I made peace with this, and it became a challenging comfort and palpable joy for me to stand 10 toes down in my authenticity. It helped me sleep better at night and smile in the mirror when I woke up." But this sort of came at a cost, and it was hard sort of fought internally to get to this place where you're able to kind of focus on yourself and no longer seek approval. We are wired to want to belong, to feel approval, a sense of community. What, if any, was the personal cost to you in getting to this place where you no longer needed approval?
Katie, this is such a good question. I'm really happy you asked it, because I think that we often think about, as you said, our authenticity and our communities and belonging. But I think one of the consequences, and I'm very open about this, of being authentic is sometimes you lose a sense of belonging in a group setting. You know, so for me, some of the costs that I had to endure was that, you know, I got a reputation of, you know, she's defensive, she's aggressive, you know, sometimes her tone. I got all of these things often. And for me, I digested them as so negative, because I just thought, I can't act right in a situation. Like, I'm not a good manager. I'm, you know, not a good team player. And I think that I had to get comfortable and okay with being like, then I just don't belong in this space. Not that I'm leaving the space, but maybe the space itself is not for me. And that's not a negative thing. That is just saying that sometimes you feel more welcome and loved and nurtured, and you can grow in one environment over another. And so I think that for me, I had to realize that, like, the cost of the reputation that follows me, the cost of being like, oh, here she comes, you know, like, yeah, here comes Deisha, the one that's going to bring up this topic or say this, or you know how she is. I used to be like, I don't want people to say that about me, because I want them to like me and I want them to be like, we love having her around and all these things. But if I'm constantly bringing up social issues, or if I'm constantly bringing up things I just don't think are right, as we are encouraged to do, speak your mind and all these things, then I have to choose whether I'm okay with this reputation, sometimes isolation, sometimes being excluded from different group things. And I decided that I was okay with that, that I'll take that, because it was too much heavy a burden to kind of just smile and be quiet in times where I was like, I want to speak up about this. And I want to be clear too and say that I'm also not above learning, right? Like, sometimes I had to learn when, you know, I had to sometimes listen and not say something, or maybe my tone was off. So it's not always, you know, that this was something that, you know, is welcome. But I just realized that I, you know, the cost of just losing a belonging and kind of being isolated or lonely or feeling weird are just things that I had to work through.
Yeah. And likability is such a trap.
Yes.
Where it can be a trap. It's not a trap for everyone. And some people are more comfortable with, as you said, not worrying about the opinions of others. I feel like I've gone through different phases in my life when I've been more in the likability trap than others. You know, I think for women, it's always an issue. You raise the point in your book that, you know, as a Black woman, this is another issue too. You don't want to fall prey to stereotypes that say that Black women are difficult or combative. And so you're being assertive versus being difficult. There's so many coded, loaded words that are used to describe women. And I really enjoyed hearing your exploration of this in the chapters where you talked about it, because it reminded me of things in my own life where I may have had to work harder at speaking up and and being direct. And I feel personally for myself, I've gotten better at it as I've aged.
Yeah.
Do you think age or experience plays any role in getting more comfortable with being uncomfortable? What's your take on that?
If you could see my face right now, I have such a big grin because when you say, like when you ask about age and mature, I love getting older, right? Like something that I dreaded when I was younger. But I think that the maturity and the clarity that has come with me becoming older, and it's not, I don't care about things anymore, but it's more of just like, I'm more sure of myself. Like I'm more sure of my voice. Like this voice has had experience and has had trauma and joy. And this voice has lived through so many things. And this voice carries this body that has as well. Like, I'm proud of it. When before it was like, how can I, like you mentioned, how can I change it a little bit to be more likable? Or how can I make sure I don't come off this way? Now I feel like I don't have that as much anymore. I think there's always a part of it, of course, but like, I don't have that partially because I'm getting older and I'm more experienced and I have a more authority over my voice and my life, authority, which I didn't know that I owned before, a power that I didn't know I had before. And part of that was only realized by me living through things, and you live through things as you get older, right? And so
yes.
I think for me, and I know that I sound like when I talk to my nieces or nephew or younger people, I'm the same person. I'm the voice that people used to tell me that they were older. Like when you get older, and I used to be like, oh gosh, like, you know, goodness, like let them find some, get a hobby. Like, you know, like, but now I like cannot say it enough. Like how just thankful I am for my age and just in this new body of freedom of finding myself and being able to speak a little bit louder. And I'm looking forward to that growing, you know, as I get older, you know, and I think it's wonderful.
Actually. Yeah, I absolutely, you know, I so agree. And that's a theme that is repeated again and again from the guests in my show, that there's this freedom that comes with age. There's, you know, sort of the things that other people put on us when we were younger, we're able to push off or reject or say no. We are more deeply confident in ourselves and our abilities. We've gotten to really hone them, you know, over the years. And we've gone through hard things and we've realized we can survive. So I think we're less fearful. Because sometimes when you're young, you're like really afraid of making mistakes and screwing up. And then like it takes screwing up and moving through them to realize, oh, like that's not the end of the road and I can afford to make more mistakes.
Right.
But you know, I also flagged something else that in your book that jumped out at me. And I want to ask you about it now since we're talking about aging. You'd said, quote, the world has cashed in on selling us ways to be our authentic selves while carelessly advising that we show up in spaces like work that aren't ready to receive all that we are, which jumped out at me. I know in the chapter in the book that you're talking about specifically about being a Black woman in spaces that are not built by or for you. But I was thinking about this through the lens of aging, because one of the taglines of our show is Age Out Loud. I have an Instagram community that says Age Out Loud. It's women sharing their stories of their age and getting to midlife. And sometimes I worry a little bit, like I am pro aging out loud. I believe we should be able to age visibly in all the spheres of our life, our personal and professional ones. But sometimes I worry that I'm encouraging people to do things that, I don't know, it doesn't work because our work worlds, you know, their ageism exists. Gendered ageism is totally real. What's your take on this in terms of aging out loud in our workplaces?
I completely agree with you. And I think that for me, environments sometimes are not ready for who we are and what we bring, including aging. And I realized that once I crossed kind of the 40 threshold and was, you know, doing all the things that I always do and how I always act and very proud of getting older. And it was very much like, it's like a silent treatment weird thing where you start to notice it little and little, just like, does it seem like it's like, not like being punished, that's a little strong, but does it seem like people are looking at me different or they're treating me different, or maybe this environment in itself is not set up for people to grow older in it. Perhaps this environment is set up for Gen Z and for younger folks, whatever, where it's not set up for that. And I think that we're realizing that a lot now, as just like my dad experienced when he was younger, he got laid off like when he was getting older. And I was like, why? How could they do that? And that's not fair, you know? And that's an extreme case. But I just definitely do see that sometimes environments are not ready and that we need to prepare each other for that, because it's important that we provide support when an environment is like comes back at us, or an environment is not welcoming, or it is a little combative. And again, it's not in a way that is so obvious, but we can start to notice like, oh, this seems a little, you know, like, you know, or I'm not getting this, or they're not really taking my ideas or something. You start to notice that. And even just like with just physical things, you know, whether it's just like deciding to, you know, have your hair naturally gray and those kind of things, like, you do walk in kind of just like, is this, you know, is this an environment that fosters that? So I think that the responsible thing to do really is to make sure that there's a support community like the one you've built. I mean, I think to myself, social media is, for all its people talk about it or whatever, all these mediums have allowed us to connect and not feel so alone and to have support. And I don't care if they're from strangers, like it doesn't matter, you know, like.
Yeah, it makes us feel braver when we feel.
It really does.
Us feel braver when we know we're not alone.
100%. 100%.
I agree that social media is so positive in that way, right? I mean, it gets a bad rap, but it really can connect you to people that are sort of advocating for the things that you care about. And I've also talked about this on the show. I had a woman come on, Dr. Amanda Hansen, and she talked about the importance of cleaning up your social media accounts and really following accounts that make you feel seen and supported. So follow age positive accounts, you know, don't follow accounts that are trying to sell you anti-aging things that make you feel bad about something as natural as aging. So I think that's, it can be, well, it's a double-edged sword, but if you use it carefully, you can really put yourself in communities and spheres where you feel so supported.
Yes. And they're just people like you. And that always feels great. I mean, we were younger. We didn't have, you know, we didn't have all this. And so I used to be like in isolation, being like, am I the only one experiencing this? And then now it's like, oh, wait, no, I'm not. And sometimes you, you know, can lean on people for solutions and support. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, you also had yourself, and you were in a very small community at one point, because there aren't a lot of people who have been White House social secretaries.
Yeah, there's not.
You know, did you ever tap in to the wisdom of people who went before you? Is there any kind of like mentor mentee? And give us a little bit of a background. What's it like to throw an event in the White House? Is it as overwhelming as it looks like it might be?
Yes, Katie. I would say, you know, the White House social secretary family is pretty tight. And we are a very small group of folks. And we just, you know, the oldest living is from Gerald Ford.
Wow.
Maria. And, you know, she is not as agile and everything as she used to be. But when I became social secretary, she helped a lot through everything. Lyndon B. Johnson, social secretary, just passed a couple of years ago. And we get together every couple, you know, usually at the holidays. And then we usually get together one other time during the year. And it is all the socials. It's nonpartisan. There's no partisan, right? But it's the one space that we can tell secrets of everything and like, whatever, and doesn't go anywhere, which is super nice, right? Like, it doesn't go anywhere. And it's just like, it's so great. And Lyndon B. Johnson, social secretary, was like, you know, one time we painted the lawn green because, you know, it was the, you know, and then everybody's shoes was green. And we were like, oh, we don't know what happened, you know? So like fun stuff like that.
That's hysterical.
Yes,
I love it.
Really great because I was the fourth social secretary. The first one, Desiree Rogers was the first African-American social secretary, then Juliana, then Jeremy. And so I was able to collect all of their stories and all of their lessons and everything else when I finally took over the top job. And you need that when you run a White House event, because a White House event, you know, it's on a national stage. It is covered by big press, and, you know, any mistake you make can end up on the front of the New York Times or MSNBC. And so running an event is very special there because you have to go through every finite detail minute by minute, but also you're very lucky. We were very lucky to work with an amazing crew of people that serve presidents regardless of who's the president, they just serve the office. And so the chefs, the butlers, the ushers, communications folks. So I was able to rely heavily on their institutional knowledge to put some of our events together. And you ask how they come together. It's a lot of meetings, a lot of planning, a lot of briefings, but we think of every detail down to the minute, down to color napkins, and we know how many guests can fit in here and what will people eat and all of that to create a dynamic event. And so, yeah, it was definitely a team effort and no day was ever the same.
I'm 100% sure. I can't remember what event you were throwing, but you said you were practically like a weather person because you were like kept checking the meteorology reports. And I could so relate to that because when you have to move your back terrace, you know, gathering inside, and even on a small scale, it's super stressful.
It is. Yeah.
I'm not going to ask you about the mistakes that wind up on the front page of newspapers, but was there a particularly like proud moment, an event that you're like, I can't believe we pulled it off and it was so amazing?
I mean, I feel like that was every day. But I would say that there was a period in which we had the Pope visit, and that was 12,000 people on the lawn. And then we had the state dinner, my first state dinner of China. China came, the leaders of China came, and that was 2 days later. And then 4 days after that, we had to go to New York and put on the United Nations General Assembly receptions, which is all the world leaders. And usually those things happen, span out, but ours all happened in less than a week. And I cannot believe to this day that we survived that because it was constant planning. Everything was different. The two events were outside. So talking about like having to move people and look at the weather. And so I would say that that triple event, the Super Bowl of events, as the New York Times called it, is something I can't believe that we pulled off flawlessly. Like there were mistakes that people didn't notice, but there was nothing like streakers, protesters, you know, like there was none of that happening, which thank goodness. And so I think that was a testament to like our level of detail and our level of teamwork.
Yeah. It was really fun to hear some of the backstories that week features in the book, and it's just really astonishing what you pulled off. So it was super fun to hear a little bit of the back behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You were very busy as social secretary. You have not really slowed down since you left the White House, because mm-hmm. I know you've continued to evolve your career and have fabulous opportunities. We get to learn about someone in the book. You were at the Ford Foundation. Mm-hmm. You were a teaching fellow at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
You've opened your own social impact company. I know you sit on several boards, but you're also the founder of something called Be Girl World. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to fill us in on what this nonprofit does.
Definitely. So Be Girl World was an organization that I started co-founded in 2014, and it empowers, equips, and educates Black teen girls to travel the world professionally and personally. It started when I noticed that, number one, the study abroad numbers are pretty dismal. For Black students studying abroad in the U.S., the number is under 5%. And then when I traveled with the president and first lady, we would travel to embassies all over the world. As you know, the president, you know, first lady would visit the country, and there would be the U.S. embassies, there's a very much a lack of Black people working in the embassies, Americans. And I'd be like, I'm so confused because there's, you know, we have Black people at home. Why are they not in the embassies? But, you know, meanwhile, you know, a lot of Black people didn't know what the Foreign Service was or how you could be a Foreign Service officer. And so we started a program where we start the education around just travel and culture and learning and global education. And when girls are freshmen and sophomores in high school, and we do things like cultural lessons, language, dance, culinary. We take them on domestic trips up to New York to learn about professional careers that are global. And then after 2 years of being in the program, the girls actually take an international trip. And so we've taken them to France, and we've taken them to Spain, we've taken them to London, this year it'll be Portugal, where they learn all types of things. And we do that in hopes that by the time they get to college, they are no longer scared to travel. They have got some resources, some education, some support under them to apply for study abroad. And then maybe that'll lead to a Foreign Service career, maybe not. And then we give scholarships to Black women who study abroad, who gotten a study abroad awarded to them. So those are the things that Be Girl World does. We most recently worked with Lonely Planet to provide 100 Black girls across the country and their parents with passports. And we just want people to know it's an option. You know, everybody, you know, you could, there's plenty of places to see in the U.S. And so we also focus on like some of the pockets of our country and our cities that are, you know, like the Italian market, right? Or, you know, the West Indian section. So we don't just focus on like you have to go outside the country. There's plenty of cultural things inside.
Yeah. I love that you're focusing on students and sort of activating the next generation of leaders, because you look at your own journey where you started mm-hmm. in the White House as an intern and where it took you, you know, providing opportunities for students and young people to be involved in our civic fabric and to expand their worldview is something that gives such positive benefits. Where can our listeners learn more about Be Girl World?
They can learn about Be Girl World at our website, which is just Be Girl. It's B-E-G-I-R-L World, WORLD.com. But they can also just go to my Instagram, ddyer, D-E-E-D-Y-E-R 267. And it's right in the bio, or at my website, deshadyer.com. They can click on it from there.
Okay, great. I'm going to put all those in the show notes. I'm going to ask you again at the end, but I just want to make sure if people are listening right now and they're intrigued and want to learn more or want to get involved, supported, or perhaps apply, you know, to be part of the programming, you know, where they can go. Tisha, we're going to be moving into our speed round in a few minutes, but before we go, I do want to ask you one last question. I know you talked in the book frequently about how your imposter syndrome flared up when you were trying new things, and you eventually learn like imposter syndrome is like not really a syndrome. It's just sort of this, you know, illusion that's often put on us because mm-hmm. we're uncomfortable trying new things because maybe we're not always welcomed, you know, and you've tried a lot of new things, right? Mm-hmm. Your first office job, White House intern, yes. You know, this coveted role, even the last day of the Obama White House, when you were invited on Air Force One, you're like, really? Like me? When we're trying new things, when we're in unfamiliar spaces, we can question our sense of belonging. I'm curious, you are a brand new author. How mm-hmm. is the imposter syndrome going?
Katie, it's going. I think that it's interesting that I kept saying to myself when I was writing it, like, should I be writing this book when I feel like I have imposter syndrome about writing a book about imposter syndrome? But I think that it's going well. And I think it's because good. The evolution of how I thought about imposter syndrome, like it was my fault and my responsibility. And as a woman, as an aging woman, as a Black woman, you know, I would turn these things around on myself, like, Tisha, you know, you can't do this, blah, 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 or you don't belong here, you don't deserve these things. And I was like, oh no, like, who's saying that? You know what I mean? Like, who are the people that are reinforcing this, or what systems are reinforcing this? And when I realized that like none of that is, that's not me. That's not the people around me. Don't say that. People support me. I had to lean more into that. And so being an author and learning this whole process has been very hard, but hard in the way that I've never done it before. And I think that part of me, you know, navigating the imposter syndrome is not only realizing that it's not my fault or responsibility, but also realizing that I need to give myself some grace and compassion. Like, no, we don't know how to do all things. So yes, we're going to be a little scared. And that's part of the process. And that's okay. So I give myself grace now. And then I also do something that, you know, that you mentioned earlier a little bit, is like, I curate my social media feed to encouraging accounts and, you know, and not, you know, to be the best author, you have to do this. It's like, no, you did it. You wrote a book. You know what I mean? Like, we're proud of you. And I'm like, that's what I need to hear, because I'm not going to probably do things all right the first time, but also, when have I ever done things the right way? Never. And they've all turned out amazing. So I'm just putting faith in that.
I got to attend this wonderful night of live oral storytelling in New York last week. It's called Generation Women. And for anyone who's listening, who's in the tri-state area or gets to New York, put this on your list. It's always a one theme, and it's five women across generations. So somebody from 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 all share their phenomenal story, whatever the theme is. And the evening is created and curated by a writer. And she got up to introduce everyone and share that her last book didn't perform as well as she wanted to when she sold it. I think it's her fifth or sixth. And she said that she really has just had to stop measuring herself from external validation. And she said, I love this book. I wrote the book I wanted to. I feel great about that. And that's what I have to focus on. And it was such a good reminder to hear somebody who's written 5 or 6 books and by any measure is accomplished, that sometimes we just have to enjoy the process or the results for ourselves and not sort of release some of the other stuff. So I'm so 100%. Glad that you're enjoying it and that you're proud that you brought this book out into the world. I, for one, loved reading it. I love having you on this show and I love supporting authors. So this has been a total treat. All right, Tisha, we're at the end of our time together. This is a speed round that we close with. It's just one to two words. All right, you're ready. All right, let's do it. Okay, writing Undiplomatic was?
Freeing.
Seeing my book for sale on Amazon feels?
Exciting.
Favorite White House event to organize?
Birthday parties.
Ooh, yes. Most complicated and complex White House events to organize?
State dinners.
Throwing parties and events is stressful. I know this because I just hosted a dozen people for Easter lunch and it was not easy. What is a lifestyle choice or hack that keeps you sane?
Flat shoes.
Ooh, I love it. Yes, I am firmly camp flat shoes. Okay. Oh, yes. Your book is called Undiplomatic, but it seems to me that you must be more diplomatic than you let on since you had a very visible, important leadership role in the White House. Did you ever consider a different title for the book? And this can be more than one word answer.
Yes, I did consider a different title for the book. There's a couple of them, but I'd say the main the main running one was Black Sheep in a White House. But I thought it was just, I thought it just sounded fun, but nobody else did. So yeah.
Nobody else did.
That was it. Yeah.
Right. Of course, I love the nod to John Lewis too. So it's such a great, such a great title. It's a great book and we're glad it's out in the world.
Yes.
All right. This is the last one. Finally, your one word answer to complete this sentence. As I age, I feel.
Hot.
Ooh, yes. Love
hot,
it.
Hot as in I feel like I look better. I don't care what anybody says. And I'm also hella hot with these flash situations.
Oh my God.
It's a dual meaning, but I feel hot. And on fire. Like I'm on fire. Like what else can I do? Like what else? I'm on fire. Like let's go.
Yes.
It's my word.
I love it. I love all the meanings. I totally get it. Hot it is. Fantastic. Yes. All right, before we say goodbye, how can our listeners keep following you and your work?
Yes. So I would say that the best way is Instagram. My Instagram is DeeDyer267 or just Disha Dyer, my name.com. It has all the links there to follow me as well. But I would say I'm most active, I say on Instagram, I have the biggest audience, give some fun updates, behind the scenes stuff. So I would say that that's the best way to find me.
Thank you so much, Tisha.
Thank you so much, Katie. It's been a joy. It's so fun.
This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. And before I say goodbye, a quick favor. We would love a 5-star podcast review. Did you enjoy today's show? If so, please take 5 minutes to write a short review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify because every review helps the show grow. Also, we are now answering listener questions on most shows. You can email me yours at katie@acertainagepod.com or come find me over on Instagram @acertainagepod and DM me your questions there. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time. And until then, age boldly, beauties.